Okay. We left off yesterday. We spent our time, obviously, on a rather wide-ranging discussion of the policy ramifications of the punitive damages regime. And as I indicated, there's a lot of debate, concern about whether it's the system functions in a way that's optimal or even desirable. What I want to focus on today is a little bit more of the mechanics of how an award is arrived at and then imposed. And in addition, the discussion in BMW about the constitutional overlay. And just by way of sort of historical background, prior to BMW Inc. versus Gore, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, had flirted with the idea of intervening, so to speak, or making its presence known with respect to punitive damage awards, but it hadn't yet held that it was going to do so. So the significance of BMW Inc. is that. This sort of long-awaited moment in which the court says, yes, this is our issue. We will enter the arena here. So that now that became a factor in state court adjudication of these cases. And secondly, the Supreme Court provided the criteria which it would use to evaluate whether or not a state had exceeded its authority to make these kinds of awards, whether due process had been observed. So again, that sort of constitutional layer is one that we need to address, but before we get there, we need to see how it is, again, that a state court goes about making a punitive damage award. We spoke yesterday of the most important factor, which is how do you distinguish the conduct that justifies an award for compensatory damages from one where the jury can properly consider and award damages for to punish the defendant. And we talked about the difference between negligence and recklessness, which can be helpful because they really do, as the Model Penal Code tries to define the difference between one and the other. We can sort of use that to provide a little more specificity to the test. But as we also saw, many of the cases essentially revolve around a relatively subjective determination that between the ordinary kinds of negligence that generate compensatory awards and the kinds of facts and circumstances that generate a punitive damage recovery, it's not always easy to put your finger on that. There's a je ne sais quoi that separates these two things. And again, that will be something you need to kind of look at as you pick up the facts of the exam and review them and say, is there something in these facts that would make a plaintiff's lawyer think about the potential for a punitive damage award? Or contrarywise, if I were representing the defendant in this case, should I be concerned about the potential for a punitive damage award? And just to give you an example of how that plays out in a real live exam, a couple of years ago, quite a few years ago, as a matter of fact, I was rummaging through Westlaw looking for a good case to use, and I stumbled across one in which it was actually a second semester exam, and as it turned out, the coverage was such that in the second semester I had a whole variety of different issues to look at. Here were the facts. A single guy, about 30 years old, as I recall, lived in a downtown setting, lived in an apartment. He woke up one night or was still awake at 2 a.m. when hunger struck him, and he decided he didn't have anything in the house to eat, so he ventured forth in search of a fast food restaurant. Well, not too far from his apartment was a kind of area where fast food was being sold, except not at 2 o'clock in the morning, which he discovered. Nobody was open at that hour. But as he's wandering across the deserted parking lot, his eye falls upon the dumpster, where he says to himself, "Self, there's probably food thrown out by this restaurant, which is quite edible, and the price is certainly right." And so in order to gain entrance to the dumpster, he climbs up on the retaining wall where this dumpster was set back into some kind of incline cut out of this. So there's a retaining wall holding up the area around it, and so he's climbing on this to get into the dumpster, and what he doesn't know is that this area had been damaged by a dump truck or whatever the dumpster forklift thing is that's supposed to lift the dumpster out and dump it into the truck and move on. He'd missed with the forks and had gouged out this retaining wall, and it was unstable. In fact, the employees of this restaurant had complained as they took out the trash, "Gee, this thing is unstable. Somebody should do something about that." And the boss responded to them, "Shut up and get back to work." Well, it was this guy climbing on the retaining wall who gets hurt, and in fact, he loses a leg. It's a it's a very serious injury. And he sues the owner of the fast food restaurant. And there are lots of other issues, for example, about the liability of the driver of the dump truck. Would that person have any liability for the fact that somebody else later got hurt? There were issues about the status of this guy, his own contributory negligence. You can see why I liked it as a fact pattern to use on an exam. Do you think there's any exposure of the defendant to punitive damages in that case? Turns out the jury awarded $600,000 to the plaintiff above and beyond his compensatory damages to punish them for their reckless, callous leaving of this retaining wall in this dangerous condition. Now that takes a lot of people by surprise. They think, "I'm not even sure the jury's going to give this guy a dime." It sounds almost like one of those cocktail party stories about what's gone wrong with the tort system. There's this guy out there dumpster diving, and he he not only gets free food out of the dumpster, you know, instead of getting free food out of the dumpster, he gets, you know, $800,000 from the jury for the injuries that he suffered because they didn't make the place safe for him to go scrounge discarded food. But that's what happened, and if you were counsel for Burger King or Hardee's or whoever it was that was the defendant in that case, I would hope that in evaluating this case for your client, you would at least ruminate over the possibility, gee, I wonder if, in addition to establishing liability for compensatory damages, the plaintiff would ask for and receive a punitive award. After all, the defendant consciously chose to leave this dangerous condition in such a fashion that it could easily have been one of those high school kids that's out, you know, working there to earn a few extra bucks, flipping burgers, and they come, you know, it happened, it was somebody else who got hurt, but it could just as easily have been, you know, somebody who was there at the employer's instruction. So maybe they should be spanked. So, again, the time we spent yesterday, I hope, was worthwhile from the standpoint that getting a handle on where to find that line is job one. But as I say, we're going to spend time today on some of the other issues that arise in figuring out if the plaintiff is asking for punitive damages, how do we go about making that award? So the first one we're going to look at here is Grimshaw. We've already referenced this, as I recall, when we talked about learned hands formula. I pointed out that there was this case in which Ford's engineers seemed to be following the learned hand formula, and the jury wasn't very happy about that. But we need to talk more about the details here of the punitive damage award. Go ahead. All in the family here, yeah. And burn injuries, along with spinal cord injuries, tend to be very expensive. Burn injuries are very painful, very disfiguring, and often require extensive, repeated surgery to try to correct or mitigate. And so they're... the damages are quite high. What was the jury's award here? And before we get there, obviously the judge doesn't except that the judge replaces that with a... Okay. And then Mrs. Grimshaw dies in the accident, and apparently there's no claim for punitive damages on her part. And what are her damages? Or Mrs. Gray, I'm sorry. So it's basically, again, I mean, this is one of the things we'll talk about when we talk about wrongful death, often remarked upon anomaly that it's more expensive to injure somebody badly than it is to kill them. By a factor here, just in terms of the compensatory award of about factor of about 5. So, or maybe 4, something like that. But again, it's not necessarily a sign that something's wrong, that the defendant pays out more to the injured victim than to the family of the decedent. Although presumably one is a worse injury than the other. Okay. So again, the jury initially evaluates the punitive damage award at $125 million, but the trial judge thinks, nah, that's too much. Does this procedure called remittiture, in which the judge says to the successful plaintiff here, look, I would grant the defendant's motion for a new trial, but I'll turn that motion down if you'll remit, give back, in a sense, all but this $3.5 million. If you're content with $3.5 million, I'll deny the motion for a new trial. But if you insist on the full award, I think we need to do this again. And you can talk to the Court of Appeals about this. Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong in insisting upon this reduction, but that's the way I see it. So when he does that, both parties are unhappy. Both the plaintiff is unhappy because the award has been reduced, and the defendant is unhappy because there's any award at all for punitive damages. And it's mostly the defendant's argument that we spend our time on here, just while we're at it. With respect to the plaintiff's motion, or the plaintiff's ground for appeal here, that the trial judge shouldn't have reduced it, most appellate courts are quite deferential to trial judges with respect to motions for a new trial. If the trial judge says, I think this was unfair, I think this was a result of passion and prejudice, I don't think it was supported by the evidence, trial judges are granted a fairly broad discretion. Unless they abuse their discretion in making that finding, the appellate court will say, you were there, I wasn't. If you say it's too much or too little, or you think there was passion and prejudice, and you don't think it was supported by the evidence, then we trust your judgment on that. Again, because the worst thing that happens is we get a new trial and the plaintiff gets to do it all over again. If on a second trial you get the same result, well, that might help us see that it's a fair result. But again, this deference is given to the trial judge with respect to a finding that a new trial is justified. But again, most of our time is spent in this opinion on responding to the defendant's challenge that there is any award at all. What's Ford objecting to here? Okay, and what specifically with okay, what does the statute set as the basis for the boundaries of a punitive damage award? What aspects of the statutory standard does Ford claim weren't met by the plaintiff in this case? Okay. One question is the issue of whether or not the plaintiffs actually proved malice. And Ford's argument is what? Why doesn't this constitute malice? Huh. Right. There's no evidence that they sat around, you know, in the engineering studio or wherever they do this stuff, that they sat around thinking, well, how can we create a death trap for Richard Grimshaw and Mrs. Gray? There's no animus against these people. Quite the contrary. They were working as hard as they thought they could to try to reduce that risk. What does the court say with respect to whether or not they met this standard of malice? Okay. Is that malicious? First of all, where have we heard this argument before? Yeah, this is Moran all over again, and from the standpoint, just as the defendant in Moran said, you've got to show there's some intent to injure, and the court said, no, they don't. You can imply malice from their flagrant indifference to the value of the plaintiff's safety. So here, the court looks at the statute and said the statute only requires proof that the defendant's conduct displayed flagrant indifference. And what's so flagrant about what the defendant did in this case? How is this different from you or me reaching for our sunglasses and taking our eyes off the road and getting into an accident and hurting somebody? If I reach back in the back seat to grab my sunglasses and take my eyes off the road and I get into an accident because I can't stop in time for the people in front of me, oops, I made a mistake. It was inadvertent. There was nothing inadvertent about this. Ford not only had all these facts and figures in front of them, instead of simply taking a risk that somebody might get hurt, Ford knew that people would get hurt. So you could almost say that Ford knowingly took these lives of all these people and caused all these burn deaths to what? Save $10 per vehicle? That's what the jury thought was so displayed this flagrant indifference. Now, again, Ford would respond by pointing out the similarity between this design decision and all the other design decisions. In making the car that you drive, somebody decided whether to put side, you know, some sort of beam or constraint so that if you're hit from the side, your car won't crumple, the intrusion won't come into the passenger or driver's side. Whether airbags should be deployed, side airbags, etc. And from Ford's perspective, this decision, like lots of other decisions, involves trading off benefits and costs and so forth and so on. They don't get it from the standpoint, where's all this moral outrage coming from? But that's, again, precisely the point at which the punitive damages regime says, in effect, now you'll get it. Ms. Monnelly?
Right. What they're working off of is the latest statistics from cars on the highway and the likelihood that a particular, and I don't know whether they can specify a little car like a Pinto as compared to a big car like a Ford Galaxy, whether it varies according to, for example, the same way insurance companies base your insurance rates on whether you're driving a kind of geezer car, or whether you're driving a 400 horsepower convertible. But you can get statistics that say, in effect, for every car on the road, there's this many of them get into this kind of collision, and based on that, I mean, these numbers are still estimates, but they're relatively intelligent estimates of how many cars will be involved in this kind of collision. With respect to the value of the burn deaths, again, which they valued at 200,000 and so forth and so on, those come out of the jury verdicts. So they, again, did their research and found out of the reported cases where an award was made for a burn injury, how much did people get? And that's old information. It's not 3.5 million or 2.5 million, but again, it's some attempt to put a number on these things. And as we talked about when we discussed the learned hand formula in general, is it that they used bad numbers here? They should have used better numbers, or is it the process at all that's offensive? To say, in effect, how could you even engage in that kind of calculation? What kind of person do you think we are here? And so, again, the question is, do we accept this sort of reasoning as being par for the course when you're involved in a complex engineering project and you have data with respect to the prospective risk that's entailed? Or do you validate the jury's perception that this is really shocking and that they want to whack Ford around a few times to make sure that Ford gets it this time? And here again, I think this is the debate, the social debate, about whether the punitive damages regime is one of the things that keeps us from a kind of corporate barbarism, that in the absence of these kinds of weapons at a jury's disposal, corporations would be even more rapacious than they already are? Or is this an example, again from Ford's perspective, the government chose not to apply these standards from 1972 and 1973. The standards were there, but Congress had been persuaded not to apply them in the 1970 model year. If this is so shocking, why isn't somebody holding Congress accountable for this? And again, from the manufacturer's perspective, we spent a lot of money lobbying our representatives in Congress. We thought it actually meant something that they postponed the adoption of these standards until we'd had more chance to get ready for them. And lo and behold, it turns out the jury's going to act in effectively a legislative capacity, not only punishing us for failing to meet a standard Congress wasn't even willing to apply, they're going to hold us accountable for punitive damages. Where's the fairness in that? So this is a poor corporation with millions. No. again, I want you to appreciate the way in which, depending upon your perspective, this is either go get 'em, Tiger, or this is a system completely out of control. And to some extent, that will be reflected in the makeup of the jury. So that as you're thinking to yourself, well, what's going to happen when that guy wants punitive damages because he lost his leg dumpster diving, I can imagine a juror who says, what? And I can imagine a juror who says, there go those, you know, rapacious corporations again. And because there's this potential swing in how different people are going to perceive this, I have to be prepared that the jury's going to be more composed of people over here or people over there, and it makes it an unpredictable outcome. Well, and just to amplify that, the likelihood that I can sue McDonald's because they sell me hamburgers that make me fat is less plausible than the other kind of case where the innocent victim of an auto crash caused by a car that goes 120 miles an hour and has a 400 horsepower engine, and the sole reason for making it in that way is to, you know, we build excitement, says Pontiac. But when you build excitement, you're also building these projectiles that wind up killing people. And the innocent victim can more easily make a case against the manufacturer. Why did you build this car in this way? It serves no purpose except to slake a rather unhealthy desire. Now, a lot of jurists would say, oh, that's bologna or some other food. Maybe bologna's off the list now, too. But in any event, you know, this is unacceptable. And maybe the jurist would say, gee, I never quite thought of it before, but now that I get hold of all of the corporate memos to think about how they can advertise this thing, how they can do all this stuff, knowing that they know it's going to be purchased by people who are going to drive it irresponsibly. And we show them commercials. This is, you know, in the fine print, closed track professional driver. But why are we showing people that this is the way, this is why you want to buy this car? Now, again, I'm not saying I would vote for that on a jury. I'm not sure most jurors would vote for it. But again, the question is, as you set up the rules by which the people like car manufacturers and people who make toys and movies and other kinds of products, to what extent should they imagine the worst case scenario of a bunch of jurors who are morally outraged that the defendant does this thing? Handgun manufacturers or firearms manufacturers are in the same boat, because the opinion about firearms is so polarized. Many people think firearms are great. Many people think that firearms are bad. And depending on who sits on the jury and what person has been injured by this,
They may have very different ideas. And again, what the gun manufacturers are inclined to do is go to Congress and say, what is it, folks? Give us a clear rule. Don't subject us to the whims of a jury. So you impanel a jury in wherever it is. They take a dislike to the product we make, and they tell the people in the rest of the country, you can't have this weapon because we disapprove of it. It ought to be for Congress or somebody else to make a judgment. If the majority of the American people think that no one should have, you know, this kind of product, fine. But once you decide it's legal, you shouldn't allow this backdoor kind of regulation through the threat of finding a jury someplace that's going to impose this huge kind of an award. And so that's the manufacturer's point of view. But again, the trial lawyers would argue it's a great thing about America is that these big, huge corporations are answerable to 12 of us, or sometimes 6 of us, impaneled on a jury. And if we don't like it, we'll tell them they can't do it. And that's called democracy. So again, the competing perceptions about whether this is a good regime or a bad regime, we've already spent a lot of time on. Okay, now, the other problems Ford had, the standard we're going to use, another problem Ford had, what's wrong with the award in this case? Okay. Right. Notice the similarity, but also the difference in comparison to vicarious liability for compensatory damages. Ford Motor Company is liable for the negligence of the people on the assembly line who don't put the right bolts in the right place. That causes an injury. On the other hand, Ford is not liable if somebody on the assembly line is having a bad day and starts cutting the hoses on the hydraulic lines because he wants the people who buy these cars to suffer serious injury. That's not Ford who does that. That's this disgruntled employee. Even if they get behind in their production schedule and the employees say, hey, we're not done with these yet, we haven't done all the safety checks, and the supervisor says, tough luck, we're behind schedule, put the covers back on, put them in the completed outbox here. Even that won't satisfy the test here, which is, to be liable for punitive damages, the corporation has to have done this thing, or someone has to have done it, who had managerial authority. Who made the decision about leaving the gas tank in the condition it was in? Yeah, this went practically up to the top of the command chain here. This is a very... What's that? But for vicarious liability, the guy on the assembly line can make Ford liable for compensatory damages. I don't have to show that the guy on the assembly line had managerial authority. But for purposes of imposing punitive damage liability, it's not enough to show that some terrible, awful thing was done by people on the assembly line. They cut all the brake linings or whatever and deliberately sabotaged these cars. That doesn't make Ford, it makes them liable. We may put them in jail for that, but it doesn't make Ford liable if the people who made this decision didn't have managerial authority. For compensatory damages, not for punitive damages. If if the behavior that you say justifies the award of punitive damages, if that behavior is either done by or the alternative is that it's ratified. So, for example, let's say Ford, we've got this a bunch of people in the quality control who are behind, and instead of actually inspecting the vehicles, they just cover them up again and ship them out the door. And somebody then gets mad at his boss and complains or reports him, whistleblows to upper management, and says, hey, a lot of these cars that you shipped out were never inspected. And then if management, in effect, says, we'll fix that next time, but we're not going to think about it now, if it's ratified subsequently, that also serves to trigger punitive damage liability. But again, the difference is that vicarious liability reaches down to a lowest level employee for compensatory damages. For punitive damages, you can only go a certain depth in the corporation before you say, gee, that's no longer the corporation. Yeah. Good question. Again, someone with managerial authority. So, you know, the night shift supervisor at McDonald's has been promoted from, you know, the drive-up window to managing the night shift, may or may not have managerial authority to fix the retaining wall. And so that would be an issue. Well, you can hold the individuals, you know, for example, the guy who has been promoted from the drive-up window to the night shift, who says, in effect, I don't worry about it, just do your job. We could hold him personally accountable, but he's worthless, typically. If you want to get a punitive damage award, you want the corporation. So to get the corporation, we don't want the individuals, we want the corporate assets. Okay, so what else in the Ford case, the Grimshaw case, we have the attribution to the corporation through this connection to management. We also have the whole business about how you calculate it, and notice that in this phase of it, we do consider the wealth of the corporation. For purposes of a compensatory award, that's not relevant. If I'm involved in an intersection collision and somebody sues me wanting damages because they say I negligently struck their car in an intersection, they can't introduce evidence that I'm worth a ton of money and I wouldn't miss the award that the plaintiff is seeking. Nor can I introduce evidence to show I'm just this poor little church mouse here and I don't have anything, so please don't make an award against me. What I have or don't have is irrelevant. But when it comes time to deciding how much of an award to make to punish me, then it's very relevant to find out if I'm a very, very wealthy guy and $50,000 I blow on an evening at the casino, wouldn't even notice it, or whether that's something that would really be a very substantial penalty and would bring me to my knees, and therefore that's the amount of the punitive damage. Yeah. Yes. Right. You're right. You're getting ready for the court The only thing that makes sense to me is that the thinking of the trial judge, ratified by the appeals court, is the very thinking that we declined to do in Moran. There are more cases like this. This isn't the only victim who's going to show up. The other 179 serious burn victims show up and get their compensatory and punitive award. Ford's going to pay dearly for this. So maybe $125 million would make sense if this were the only case, but we know it isn't. Now, again, the court in Moran said, we can't think about that. It's not our job to line up all these other victims and try to coordinate. Maybe such coordination would be desirable, but it's got to come from the legislature. Here, apparently, the only thing I can think of is that the trial judge, in the back of his head, was thinking about this, and that's why he cut it down from 125 to 3.5. Because, as you say, you're all ready for the court to hit him with a sledgehammer, and they hit him with a pea shooter. So, okay. Now, a few minutes on BMW Inc. versus Gore. Again, this is sort of a poster child for the defense to say, here's Dr. Gore buys a BMW. It's been shot, repainted. And he discovers this when he goes to add pinstriping to it and is furious that they lied to him about whether this was really a new car. He gets testimony that if it were really new, as opposed to this repainted BMW, it would be worth $4,000 more. And there's no contradictory testimony. That seems a little high to me. I haven't been in the market for a new BMW recently, but if I were, and someone says, well, here's a new BMW, there's one just like it, except it's been repainted, I think before they got to the point of saying, we'll give you $4,000 off if you take the one that's repainted, I think I'd take the cheaper one. I don't think you'd have to get to $4,000 before I'd bite on the savings, but that probably shows why I'm not buying new BMWs. In any event, the point is that's the amount of the compensatory award, and the jury then says, well, gee, there are 1,000 other cases like this, so we're going to multiply 1,000 times 4,000, and that's 4 million, so that's how much BMW should pay as punishment for their fraudulent behavior. BMW first appeals this to the Alabama Supreme Court, and they say, yeah, 4 million really is too much. Let's make it 2 million. And BMW, in turn, appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court. As I said, for the first time, the Supreme Court says, we're going to enter this fray. We think it is our job, over the protest of Scalia and other dissenters, we think it is our job to make sure that these awards are reasonable. And $4 million is simply unreasonable, and they send it back down with these three, and this is the point here, these three criteria that are on page 32, right-hand column. In evaluating whether the award is so excessive as to violate the due process guarantee, you have to look at, what kind of behavior we're talking about. Are we talking about subjecting people to horrible burn deaths? In which case $3.5 million is the right figure, or are we talking about repainting cars and selling them as though they were new, which is $4 million? No, just joking. You also have to look at the ratio between the compensatory award and the punitive award. Here the ratio was 1,000 to 1. That's a pretty steep markup there. As compared, again, $2.5 million, $3.5 million, this is more, obviously, more reasonable. And finally, look at other kinds of punishment. What would happen, for example, if the state of Alabama filed an action against BMW for consumer fraud?
What sort of penalties could the state of Alabama impose, civil or criminal remedies? Depending on what those look like, we'll get some idea of whether this interval is reasonable. Does this give us a clear idea of where we are? No. But at least provides the starting point for our discussion. When they get to the end of it, the Alabama Supreme Court says, come to think of it, strike the $2 million we set last time. It's now going to be $50,000. And Dr. Gore, although he's not, you know, necessarily the guy I feel the sorriest for in all the cases we've ever read about, he's gone from this huge windfall to probably not enough money to pay his lawyers. I mean, to take this case up to the Supreme Court of Alabama, to the U.S. Supreme Court, back to the Supreme Court of Alabama, I'm sure it costs more than $50,000. He winds up essentially with nothing. Poor Dr. Gore. Anyway, okay. So, again, everybody's equivalently miserable here, and maybe that's not a bad way to end. Tomorrow, talk briefly about attorney's fees, and then we'll switch over to talking about wrongful death.